Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. If this is your morning commute, good morning to you. This is the Cinematica Podcast with Season 4, Episode 6 of the show. And I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio, we're welcoming back the Wanderer.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Hello, campers. How are we doing?
Good. Simon Wherry. And over in the far corner, I was just about to say,
I'm just thinking of Wet Hot American Summer and the kid who's doing the radio show, but nothing's actually plugged in, and he's been doing the radio show all summer.
And nobody's listening.
Yeah, that's us.
Disconcertingly close to the truth. And over in the far corner, Kaylee Carruthers.
Yes.
Welcome, Kaylee.
Hello.
So, Si, where were you last week? We missed you.
I was at another movie conference, really, convention. So this started on the Tuesday, finished on the Thursday, and then we had our independent exhibitors AGM meeting on the Friday. So busy week.
Yeah, and did you get a lot done? Did you change the world or your own little part of it?
Or was it more boozing and schmoozing?
Well, yeah. There was definitely a lot of boozing and schmoozing.
What was in the goodie bags this time around?
Mm. You know, there were just DVDs.
Who watches DVDs these days?
Chocolate sometimes.
Oh, some M&Ms?
Yeah, some M&Ms.
There was a bag of M&Ms.
There was, there you go. You see M&Ms, you quite often get like a DVD and then you get like what they're going to release for the next few months and stuff, information about that. I think, you know, they should be handing out stuff like, I don't know, little chocolate Oscars, and they should get a bit ambitious.
They should at least throw in a bag of Maltesers as well.
Yep.
Come on.
Yeah, little bottles of whiskey from the mini bars in the hotels and that sort of stuff.
You know, one of those little mini bottles of gin and a lemon.
Yeah, and a lemon. So good luck. Something like that.
Yeah, well, at this point in time, it's a long time since I have been at one of those conferences. I seem to recall a movie theatre owner of our acquaintance had a fantastic time at one of the parties. Brilliant night, you know, because there was lots of free drinks. It was sponsored by, you know, one of the big suppliers of the chains. And he went to bed very, very happy and then woke up the next morning and found that he'd slept on top of the free chocolate that they leave on your bed.
Oh, right.
And he looked down and got the shock of his life with this melted chocolate.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty tame result, you know, story about what goes on at these things. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was it's a lot of fun, and it's really good to be in an environment where everyone sort of gets together and shares issues and what's happening in the industry.
Yeah.
So we don't do it enough, really.
Indeed, indeed. Well, until talking of what we don't do enough, we don't do Cinematica enough. We should be daily. We should be like,
oh my gosh,
Variety.
Can you imagine?
Like a breakfast show. We should be the Cinematica's morning zoo.
Yeah, that's right. I reckon it'd be great.
On today's program, he gets all BBC on it just for a moment. On today's program, Kon-Tiki is a real-life adventure on the high seas. Its real-lifeness will be debated a little bit later on. The Rock goes undercover to bring down some drug dealers in Snitch. And we talk to Andy Miller from the Academy Cinema in Auckland about the exciting developments there. As well as we get a report from a Kiwi on the Croisette at Cannes. Sarah Rees from the French Film Festival will join us a little
like a
bit later on.
A Croisette? Just wondering.
Okay. Not a croisson.
Oh,
a Croisette.
Not a B-day. Remember B-days?
No, I've never lived in a flat that's had one. I think I think your rent goes up quite a lot when you have two of those.
I remember being in a house as a kid and we had a bidet and you could play with it and it would shoot water up in the air and you could actually touch the ceiling with it. There you go. It was a lot of fun. We never really used it for the purpose it was intended for, but that's what a bidet does.
Excellent. Well,
you don't see them in new houses anymore.
No. There's a lot of things you don't see in houses anywhere. Like, you don't see waterbeds.
So
whatever happened to waterbeds?
What about houses that you've
health
lived in?
Health and safety. That's what happened to waterbeds.
What about houses you've lived in, Kaylee?
B-days? Is it a big thing in Canada? You want to be careful that you didn't freeze. You don't want freezing water.
No.
That'd be terrible. Oh, my gosh. A friend of mine for a short time did house valuations.
You go. Got it.
A friend of mine for a short time did house valuations, and she had to, like, value evaluate, I don't know, put value on the B-Day in the house as like the entire house. So.
See, my main objective achieved. I just wanted to hear her say house, you know? Fantastic.
We've been bidet. We call them bidets.
In Canada.
In Canada, because, you know, more French.
Bidet. Right.
The listeners will be pleased to know that before we started recording, I said to everybody around the table, let's make this one a really tight show, shall we?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, waffle you know, on. We do, you know, we go with the best of intentions, but it's time for the mailbag, Kaylee.
Yes.
We've got some two-word reviews, including one that is going to change our iTunes rating.
What's in the bird's basket fluttering by with all the mail today? Oh, fantastic. Look at that.
The Merca tweeted us two-word review from SIF 2013 for F-Up equals Coen-esque crimedy. # just want to hear you say the title on the show.
And you gave it a good go, but when you say F-Up, you really mean there's a bit of language there, isn't
it? Yeah, there's an F-bomb.
Right, an F-bomb. So Google that and see what you find.
Yeah.
Google F-bomb?
No, F-up.
Okay.
And see if you find the movie, which is unlikely. But the Merca, he's at SIFF, which is the Seattle International Film Festival, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, film festivals everywhere. And he's made a special trip to the Pacific Northwest to check out the movies there.
Yes, and he was recently in Vancouver. So I was chatting with him.
Him tips, yeah.
Yeah, so if anyone's going to Vancouver, let me know, and I'll tell you where to go eat, where to not eat.
Brilliant.
That's it. That's all we have.
Okay. And so then what have people been going to see? Let's just do a quick rundown of the top five.
Mm-hmm. In at number five, still at five, is The Croods. At four...
That's brilliant. That's a brilliant series of results for them.
It's just hung in there, isn't it?
Sixth week in release.
And internationally, it's now done more than Wreck-It Ralph and quite a few others. It's like one of the biggest animated films of all time.
Mm. At four, still at four, Song for Marion.
Yay!
Yeah, and I some people I know who you'd think would be a little bit sort of tougher have ended up being quite moved by Song for Marion.
I'd put myself in that category.
I saw a tweet that someone cried their eyes out watching it. Opening at number three is Snitch, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. Sitting at number two still this week is Iron Man 3, and holding on to the number one position, Star Trek Into Darkness.
And do we see any drop off? What's the reduction?
33.3%.
Not bad.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yep. And but we're also going into a relatively quiet period for blockbusters, aren't we? So we've got a couple of weeks.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Except for this week, we have the Hangover 3.
You've got Hangover 3. You've got Gatsby. You've got Man of Steel. You've got the Lone Ranger.
I'm thinking about the next couple of weeks.
When's
Gatsby?
Gatsby's 6th of June.
Mm.
Man of Steel's 27th of June.
Yeah, but that's two.
Lone Ranger's 4th of July.
All right, so this week and next week is really what I was trying to say. And I don't count The Hangover 3 as being blockbuster material. It's not a big action superhero thing. You know, I'm guessing what I'm saying.
Box office, though. It
does, but I don't think The Hangover 3 is really... It's not really going after exactly the same audience as Star Trek, is it? Because bearing in mind, it's pretty adult. You know, I would say that it would be R-rated.
R-16.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. R-16, right? So I don't think, therefore... R16 can't be blockbuster by definition because it can't get the kids.
No, it can be a blockbuster for adults.
Nope.
Why not?
No, that's a subsection.
Bridesmaids? Is that a blockbuster?
No.
Oh, you're mad. What about the worldwide box office that it does?
Yeah, but that's not blockbuster. That's not the absolute tempo. That's not record setting. That's not the kind of thing that keeps studio executives in their jobs.
So, when an R16 film comes out and it does it does the most box office of an R16 film ever before.
Yeah, that's just a really good R16 movie. So.
Right, okay, you got that, everyone?
Yeah, and
you can see the logic.
Yeah. Facts of the week.
All right, thanks very much for that, Kaylee. It is time for us to head out on the high seas and do a bit of exploring.
By crossing the Pacific for 5,000 miles, I will prove that Peruvians were the first to settle Polynesia. It's further than from Chicago to Moscow.
Look around you. Every book in here offers some theory or another.
Mr. Hardo,
Doubtless the story of Norwegians drowning in the Pacific will sell a lot of magazines. But not this one.
You want your theory to be accepted? Then go ahead. Drift from Peru to Polynesia on a balsa wood raft.
My memory of balsa wood is that it was a pretty precarious stuff.
You can make a plane out of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Light enough to fly.
Yeah.
But would you necessarily want to risk your life on it?
Cut yourself too, like those sharp knives, the blades, and your balsa is straight through on you. Oh, oh,
Simon, no. We set Simon a little bit of homework, that is he...
thanks very much. That's not quite accurate.
Yeah, well, okay. So
we
maybe
talked about it for a minute beforehand.
Yeah. We told him to go to Wikipedia and do something.
No,
okay. He doesn't have an iPad today.
I do actually. It's in my bag, but it was too far away. Must, right. Like Star Trek, must reach bag. Must.
The needs, but hold can't. On. Sorry, Simon. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. Yeah. So
needs of the one.
Tor Heyerdahl. Tor Heyerdahl, 1948, made this incredible journey across the Pacific Ocean to try and prove a theory of his, and that is that the Polynesian islands were settled by
Peruvians
specifically.
Peruvians.
People from South America. So I presume you learnt this about this story at primary school like I did.
Yeah, about Kentucky, yeah.
Yeah, so the film itself, what did you make of it?
I found it a really neat, interesting film. Yeah, I love watching these films about... I mean, you know, it starts off on the island, in the islands with him and his wife at the time. I think they were married at the start, yeah. And they're sort of, you know, both have this shared interest of studying way people are living on the islands, and he starts making these sort of assumptions of what he's seeing, not just about the people, but also I think about the fauna and the animals and around
pineapples.
The place. Yeah, pineapples and you know, that sort of stuff. So he starts to make some sort of assert that that people actually migrated from Peru, and he, you know, they go back to and it's interesting because at the start there, his wife gets injured. And he makes the decision, I think, from memory, to leave everything behind, like all their research and so on. He drops the book. He says, no, forget it, and gets her out of there. And they, she's lucky to survive. And yet you think later on in the film, you're not so sure that he would do that. You know, as it
that's
goes
right,
on,
exactly.
You know,
like, his character changes his character, and he hardens up, doesn't he?
Because everyone is saying that he's wrong. Like, he comes out with this this hypothesis, and everyone, you know, National Geographic, everyone sort of says, "No, you're bonkers. It's just not accurate and not correct." And so I guess to prove the point, he actually physically goes out and does it.
Stubborn beggar.
Yeah, and that's when the film gets really interesting. I mean, I think when they're on the water is the best part of the film.
Exactly. That whole first section really just sets up the journey, doesn't it? And it sets up the characters, and you realise these are the things that amazed me. One is that nobody really knew what they were doing. That you know, this wouldn't happen nowadays. That if you were going to do an exploration like
would you take a fridge salesman with you? I don't think so.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, and they all were enthusiastic amateurs, and they were keen to follow Heyerdahl and see what happened. But they, you know, they weren't really the most efficient and effective navigators. They didn't have huge amounts of sailing experience. It was doomed, really. And yet somehow they managed to pull it off.
Which I think. And maybe the film doesn't capture it enough, but he must have been an incredibly charismatic person to instill that level of confidence in these guys to go away and do that.
It's a question you keep asking yourself because he's such a dick at times.
Well, he's just dogged.
Yeah.
You know, he's not – and lacking in humour at times. Like, he's just very dogged and determined. But that's his whole career, isn't it? That's on the line. And it's interesting when you see these films about, you know, academics and they're kind of – you know, it's their passion and it's all that – it consumes them completely And that's what his character does, you know, at the cost of his marriage, and potentially at the cost of people's lives, he's going to prove that this is correct.
There's a lovely scene as they leave the harbour in Peru, and there they all are in their 1940s suits and ties.
That's insane.
On this raft,
yeah.
You know, and you think, you people are nuts. And then it's about 5 minutes later that they realise they can't steer. And that if it's going to get anywhere, they're just going to drift. You know, it's like entirely up to the current whether they are going to make it or not. And you know, it is one of the classic boys' own stories of sort of daring do. And you know, on that basis, it's quite thrilling. And there's It's also gorgeous to look at, isn't it? Kaylee, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it. And, of course, I'm going to make this this reference, but, of course, I loved Life of Pi at the beginning of the year. You know, that's a sort of quiet, being out in the ocean, just being surrounded by hopelessness, basically, and being stuck at the hands of the currents. It was a lot different than I thought it would be, because it does have that cinematic setup. When you're on the raft, it does cut away to other bits of the story, and there's other things going on, which is very interesting. And basically the whole time there on the ocean, I was just like so anxious and so excited and so wrapped up in it that I was clutching a pillow being like, what's gonna happen? Like,
and it does have that tension, doesn't it? It really does have that tension.
And it's a really good adventure story. You know, and bits of it have been dramatized and, you know, taken slightly out of context to be more entertaining and appeal to a cinema audience. But I thought it was a great film, especially for something that was made on $15 million US that was shot on the raft, you know, like a real raft out on the ocean. That's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, if you want to know more about the story and how it got made, check out last week's episode of the show, because there was an interview that I managed to get with Espen Sandberg, one of the co-directors of the film, and he tells in that interview quite a lot of the detail about how the film got made and some of the choices that they made, including shooting out on the ocean when they could have used CGI and a tank, and it would have probably made life a lot easier. But the raft that they're using for the film is actually a raft that was made by Heyerdahl's grandson to recreate the voyage, to prove, as if it still has to be proved, that it can be done again. And so the raft that they're on in the film is, in fact, the ocean-going raft.
In some ways, you know, like, because there are definitely, I mean, I've bumped into people in the foyer who say, you know, it's great, but, you know, it's factually, it's not correct. His theory was wrong, you know, and you go, and that may be the case, but ultimately, you know, it's an incredible story about how people would take a leap of faith like that and follow their convictions and see it through right to the end at whatever cost. And, I, you know, that alone gives it, you know, like a heck of a lot of, mana in my view. I really enjoyed it. And the way they capture that sense in the ocean, like the scale of the ocean and this tiny little piece of driftwood.
It is. floating there. And the ropes are rotting, and you know, you're
that's
thinking,
right. And oh, that guy, yeah, the constant banging of the, you know, the logs and stuff, and that guy's going, but they're filling it with water. Like they're starting to absorb the water.
Yeah. And what happens, that the shark, they mistake the shark repellent for salt or something, and they eat it.
That's right. I had some funny moments as well.
So it is a strong film. I don't think you know, whether you agree with the theory or not, you've still got to respect the journey that these guys took. Let's go around the table now and see if we can sum this up in two words. Kaylee?
My two words for Kon-Tiki are true adventure.
Epic adventure for me.
Okay, my two words for Kon-Tiki, boy's own.
I should have never taken that package. I'm not a drug dealer. I swear to you, Dad. You believe me, right?
Of course I believe you.
This is a federal case. The mandatory minimum laws are very simple. Jason is facing 10 years in prison.
10 years?
Get down! On the ground!
United States versus Jason Collins.
I believe in the mandatory minimum laws.
Please, I just want to help my son.
We need your son to help us make arrests before we can help him reduce his sentence.
But like setting someone up? I won't do it.
What if I did it for him? What if I helped you make arrests?
That is Snitch, featuring the unmistakable voice of Susan Sarandon. You know, pretty easy to recognize her. This is a film that's being sold as a Rock, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock action movie. You know,
like, but he isn't The Rock anymore, is he?
No, I know. I call him The Rock.
About this,
who is he?
I was thinking about this last night when I was brushing my teeth, and I was like, you know what? Dwayne Johnson has done okay. Like, he's sort of separated himself from The Rock. It's not The Rock anymore in the movie. It's Dwayne Johnson. He's getting film roles.
He's still wrestling, though.
He's The Rock.
Yeah, he still comes back for special wrestling occasions, yeah. And
he probably gets paid a lot.
He had to have emergency surgery on a hernia because of he had an epic televised wrestling bout with John Cena. who is the other big sort of movie star wrestler.
He's not a movie star.
He's made a couple of movies. Yeah. Well, I mean, of all of them, since Hulk Hogan, these are the two, right? These are the two that have made the leap. Right. Yeah. Anyway, so he does still wrestle. So he is still The Rock, I'm guessing, when he goes back to that career.
Mm.
But I don't know. I find when I write reviews about films that he's in, I still have to put Dwayne The Rock Johnson, just because if I say Dwayne Johnson, I actually assume that half the people reading my review won't know who I'm talking about. Now, people, please, listeners, tweet
you
us.
You could take Dwayne Johnson out of it, really, and just say The Rock, and
everyone would get it, exactly. Yeah. Mm. But if I'm wrong, if now Dwayne Johnson is at Channing Tatum levels of name recognition, then I would happily put The Rock to bed. But unfortunately, I suspect that...
I'm not going to say that joke.
Yeah, you can never let it go.
Anyway, so the idea behind this film is that Dwayne Johnson plays a successful businessman who transports construction materials around America, and in the construction downturn because of the global financial crisis,
he turns to stripping. Oh no!
That would be a Channing Tatum film. No, he turns to dealing drugs. No, well, not quite. He his son, who is just a little bit naive, says that to a mate who's living in Mexico. Yeah, I'll take that package. I'll sign for that package if you send it to me. And he does, and unfortunately inside the package were drugs.
Yeah, you see, I've seen Customs on TV, you know, the Customs TV show, and they've got those cards, and they always bring them out and say, well, but you signed here to say that you'd packed your bag.
Mm.
I'm sorry, it doesn't cut it.
No, exactly. So anyway, so he and the problem, of course, in America, as we know from the documentary The House I Live In, mandatory... Stop it. The mandatory minimum sentences, which means that because there were so many ecstasy tablets in this box, he's considered to be a dealer. First offense, 10 years. This kid's only 18 years old. And so the feds, they say, look, you know, if you turn on some dealers, if you give up your contacts, then we will reduce your sentence. But of course, this kid doesn't know any dealers. He's just a naive kid, so he's going to be stuck with 10 years in prison. The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, decides that the only way he can save his kid from all this jail time is if he goes undercover himself and tries to track down some drug dealers. So he persuades Susan Sarandon, who's the local DA, that to let him try and get in touch with some drug dealers and do this bizzo. And of course, incredibly risky.
It sounds a lot like that contraband thing.
Yeah, but it's like 10 times better.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's good.
It is good. I liked it. I liked it a lot. A lot more than I was expecting to be honest. I mean, I do think that Dwayne Johnson is real movie star quality. Mm. He's really, really watchable.
Well, you like watching him, don't you? Yeah, I don't really mind often what he's in, even how banal it could be. Yeah. I like watching him.
Well, this is a different thing for him. Because
Guns of Steel.
Usually with Dwayne Johnson, you've got two different kind of roles. You've got the kiddie films, you know, like Tooth Fairy or what have you, where he's playing against type, and he's usually the butt of the jokes in those films. Or there's the big cartoony action movies where he's the alpha male, you know, he's dominating the scenes, you know, he's a military or whatever. Mm. He's in the middle, and he plays a family guy who's just a businessman. He doesn't really know what he's letting himself in for. He is dominated by the drug dealers and has to play very much a subdued role in order to be able to win their trust. And it's a really interesting performance from him because he's still enormous, right? Mm. He still walks into a room and he's big, and yet he has to play the second fiddle to these really dominant but not nearly as physically dominant characters. So it's an interesting acting challenge for him.
I saw a little bit of him recently in Pain and Gain.
Oh,
you've seen some of that?
Just a little snippet.
Okay.
Yeah, well, pretty much the trailer, which you yeah, but...
Looking forward to
him. Well, he looks kind of... He comes across as a big teddy bear, really, in a way. Mm. And that, but anyway.
Yeah. Look. Well, have we got a date for Pain and Gain? By the way, is that up on your board?
Well, I'm not sure if it's one.
Never mind. Don't, let's not.
No. Here you go.
Get off track.
No, that's all right. We've got tons of time. Right. Here we go. Where are we? What's the? Oh,
it's in August. I think it's the 15th.
Oh, you 8th.
8th.
Okay.
8th of August, everyone. Mark it down.
Brilliant.
Get pumping.
And Mark Wahlberg, of course, in that as well. Pain and Gain. Mm. So, Snitch, it's a much more gritty, sort of realistic drama than it is the big action movie that you might have been expecting from the trailers. The final 10 minutes does have a lot of action. There's a big car chase. There's it gets very exciting in that final sort of clash between all of the different sort of sides involved. But it's actually much more of a gritty drama with a social conscience as well, because it very much it keeps reminding you that the only reason that everybody is in this situation is because of these crazy minimum sentences. And if you watched The House I Live In, which was the documentary about the war on drugs, you'll see that the argument against criminalizing drugs is so strong now. The amount of money that could be saved, the amount of human waste that it is involved. This film is a perfect counterpoint to that. It works very much along that. So I'm going to just check. Anybody else around the table seen this one?
No.
The old snitcheroo.
Jimmy the Snitch.
Yeah.
Well, two fingers.
Okay.
Jimmy two fingers.
I do recommend this, and I get the feeling that if you get a chance to see it, then you won't regret it, because it's got something about it which I really liked. So, but my two word review before we move on to the news, my two word review for Dwayne Johnson in Snitch is, can I sort of cheat a little bit? The Rock cries.
Oh, very good.
Mm.
Very good.
Time for some news now.
Right, to start off our news today, we are going to tell you about the new New Zealand Film Festival announcements.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Thanks very much to those guys for making sure that we get this information before we go to air, because this is going to be a topic of conversation once the show comes out.
Mm. So to dive right in, we have the world premiere of Romeo and Juliet, A Love Song, which is a New Zealand film. And it's a retelling of Shakespeare's Tale of Teen Love, which has been reimagined as a rock opera set in a beachside caravan park, which that wins me over. I want to see that.
It
sounds like Kaitiri over Christmas.
I have had this explained to me, and it does seem like, unlike any New Zealand film ever made, and on that basis alone, I think we should just be really excited about it. So, yeah, very, very exciting. Talking of Shakespeare.
Yes, something I'm very excited to see, the much-talked-about Much Ado About Nothing by Joss Whedon, which features his usual cast of regulars who breathe some fresh life into Shakespeare's comedy of romantic gamemanship. And if you've seen the trailer, it looks quite interesting.
And shot in only like 18 days or something.
Thing, yeah, you know. And it was imagined over a dinner party and written over a dinner party, and then everyone got back together and shot it in black and white.
I was once in a production of Much Ado About Nothing, a summer Shakespeare many years ago, and I played Don John, the villain of the piece. And when, do you remember Kenneth Branagh made a film of Much Ado About Nothing maybe 15 years ago? And I was very excited to see, you know, oh, which movie star is going to be playing me? And Keanu Reeves.
What
my part.
But now there's the film Don John, written and directed by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
So
there is an alternative. But I'm not sure. I should check out with IMDb who's playing Don John in the Joss Whedon Much Ado About Nothing, because you know it better be somebody really, really good looking.
Maybe you'll get Nathan Fillion.
Maybe. Mm. So also there's a couple of movies announced with theatre as a sort of theme. Becoming Traviata by Philippe Bazier is soprano Natalie Dessay, acclaimed for her dramatic brilliance, rehearsing La Traviata in intense creative collaboration with director Jean-François Souvarier. So this is a backstage documentary. Not timed, but I would say aimed at the people who are really digging those Met Opera movies and are used to seeing opera on the big screen now with that program. So I think that one's going to go down well as well. And this is amazing. I didn't know that he was still making films, but Manuel de Oliveira, who is the oldest living filmmaker in the world, the Portuguese director, his new film Gebo and the Shadow. Manuel de Oliveira is 104 years old and is still making films, and he's made this latest one. It's based on a play, and it stars Claudia Cardinale, Jean Moreau, and Michael Lonsdale, who are all spring chickens compared to the director. So that one, and actually you know, there's no surprise that this is in the International Film Festival. I think Bill's been a fan of De Oliveira. His films are always programmed, and I think it's really good. And back to you, Kaylee, for the, to sum up the end.
Yes, and the final film that was announced today is What Maisie Knew, an American film starring Steve Coogan and Julianne Moore as divorcing parents that is seen through the viewpoint of six-year-old Maisie, which is played by the amazing Onata April. And there's been a lot of really good critical review on this so far, and I'm very excited to see it because also Alexander Skarsgård is in it, and how can you go wrong with that?
Indeed. So look, that's another strong release coming out of the New Zealand International Film Festival. Just to let you know that when the full program is released, I will be up in Auckland for that, reporting for Cinematica, and we'll be talking to all of the assembled multitudes, and to Bill as well, of course, about that program. So listen out for that later on in June.
Mm-hmm.
Another piece of news, I didn't feed this one to you, Kaylee, but another piece of news, On Film magazine is being relaunched under the editorship of yours truly, and the new magazine will be on the shelves around the 25th of June. But in the meantime, the website's been relaunched, so if you want to check out onfilm.co.nz, the magazine and the brand has been around New Zealand for over 30 years, and it's the production industry magazine, so it'll give people a really good idea about what's going on in the film and television business, and we're expanding it out into online and gaming and various other sort of associated industries. So that's all very exciting and very, very time-consuming from my point of view. And another, I suppose we're about to talk about Cannes with Sarah Rees, but I don't know if you've been following the announcements out of Cannes and the premieres and anything that you've been particularly excited about. Of course, Only God Forgives had its premiere there, I think, overnight. Ryan Gosling wasn't there for the red carpet or the press conference. He sent his regrets. On Only God Forgives, which, of course, is the follow-up to Drive, with made by Nicholas Winding Refn. The Coen brothers, Inside Llewyn Davis, that's had very, very strong reviews. Doesn't come out here till after Christmas, so maybe early January, I think, it's due out here. So that's a long time to wait for that particular film. I was very interested to read reviews.
Maybe a hint at the Oscars, though.
Yeah, definitely. That timing is always a sign that the distributors think they know they've got something really hot.
That's right.
I'm really interested in a film that I saw a review of this morning, the new film starring Robert Redford called All Is Lost. Have you heard about this?
No.
It's made by the guy who directed Margin Call, wrote and directed Margin Call. And Robert Redford plays a sailor lost at sea on his yacht, which is sinking, and he's the only character.
So it wasn't about a super fund?
No. Okay. But he's the only character in it, and apparently there's only like two lines of dialogue. And and Redford is apparently amazing, which we haven't been able to say for a while. So that's interesting stuff. Behind the Candelabra, of course, which is also played very recently, that's actually not going to be released to cinemas in the US because it's an HBO TV movie. It's Steven Soderbergh's film about Liberace, starring Michael Douglas and Matt Damon.
Yeah, which
apparently it is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a great subject. It's going to be vivid. It's going to be funny. It's got apparently Michael Douglas is just off the scale brilliant in it.
So interestingly though, if it's being released through on HBO in the US, it won't qualify for Oscar contention. Will be a theatrical release elsewhere.
Yeah,
which is an interesting combo, really.
Exactly.
But they can still get the Emmy or the Golden Globe.
Yeah, but
what are they?
My shop's cluttered with those things. You know, they're everywhere.
Precisely. And interestingly that it's already been named as a contender for the top prizes at Cannes. And there was an announcement earlier on this morning that it has been added to the Sydney Film Festival lineup, which maybe that gives us an idea about whether it'll screen at the New Zealand International Film Festival as well. Or, you know, the worry is, of course, from a big screen point of view, is that something like Soho, with its relationship with HBO, will snap it up before that, and it might not make it to the big screen in New Zealand.
So, well, it'd be interesting to see, won't it? Because, I mean, that's a real it's a real change from the traditional release patterns.
There's a lot of that stuff happening. A lot of big names going to television to make stuff. I saw a trailer for a new TV comedy series starring Robin Williams the other day. You know, it's like Robin Williams was at one point one of the biggest movie stars.
Morph and Mindy reboot.
No, it's not. Sadly, I wish it was.
Remember
that
jacket, the puffer jacket, the colourful puffer jacket. Yeah,
the body warmer.
Don't you remember? No.
What?
Morph and Mindy.
Oh, I've only watched little bits of Morgan Mindy.
On YouTube. You haven't? No, you really? Okay, we need to do some more edumacation required.
I don't know if you can sit through that. Even though, big raps to Jones for playing at 8.5 Hot Mum and Dad's Army.
For you, from a nostalgia point of view, now I know that you're aging yourself, boy, over there.
Love it.
On the subject of Cannes, yesterday at very early in the morning French time, I spoke with Sarah Rees, who is the director of the New Zealand version of the French Film Festival. She's in Cannes at the moment, so she gave us a little bit of our time to tell us what she's been up to. Sarah Rees from the French Film Festival. She is at the Cannes Film Festival at the moment. Sarah, you're joining us on the line from your south of France accommodations. Welcome to Cinematica.
Thank you, Dan. It's very nice to be on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I wish I was actually there with you rather than at the other end of a transcontinental phone line, but, you know, we do what we can, I suppose.
Yeah. One day you can come back over.
Exactly. We're going to do a live show from Cannes one day, I'm sure. And the other thing, of course.
I think that'd be cool.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing is that you're going to paint us a bit of a picture of what it's like to be at the Cannes Film Festival. It's in the middle at the moment, isn't it? It's got another week to go.
Yeah, they wrap up on Sunday, I think it is.
Oh, okay, so less than a week.
Right. Closing night ceremony on Sunday. So it's gone incredibly quickly. I've sort of lost track of time a bit. But basically, I'm over here for a couple of reasons, mainly just going to as many possible French films as I can see in the space of 10 days and sort of getting an idea of, an early idea, I guess you could say, for our program for next year. And the other is just really networking with all the people that I work with throughout the year and finally meeting them after years of communicating via email and phone. So it's been really, really successful so far.
Yeah, because the French Film Festival in New Zealand has been getting quite a lot of support from, I can't remember what the institution's called, but the equivalent of the New Zealand Film Commission in France. They did a lot of work setting up media opportunities for your publicity, didn't they, this year? So you've got to meet up with those guys?
Yeah, so we work with Uni France quite a bit for the publicity level. They hold a fantastic press junket every year in Paris. And it's just been kind of invaluable for us this year, and we're just hoping to continue that further in the further years and also have their help, you know, bringing talent over to New Zealand during the festival and so forth. So I'm actually meeting up with them today, which I'm looking forward to.
Brilliant. Hey, you're in France and you're looking out for French films. Did you actually need to go to the Cannes Film Festival? Or could you just go to like the Nice Multiplex?
there are obviously three different parts of the Cannes Film Festival. One is obviously the official sort of competition that's happening with the films that are in competition and the competition part, the director's fortnight and Un Certain Regard. And so those are obviously premiere screenings and so forth before the rest of the world sees them. But then there's also the film market, there are over, I think, 200 projections a day of different films from around the world that sales agents are trying to sell to people. And I think that for me to be able to go and see just as many films like that I wouldn't normally get to see, you know, I think that's been very, very valuable.
Did you just say 200 a day?
Something like that, or there's a huge amount. I don't even know the number, but if you look at the screening timetable per day, you could like scroll down for miles and there's just so many.
How do you choose?
200 might be a bit of an exaggeration, but...
How do you choose?
How do I choose? Oh, well, I mean, a lot of it's done pre-festival sort of research, seeing what I think would appeal to our audience and so forth. And basically just, I mean, they've got a fantastic application for people attending the market to create a sort of screening timetable per day with the films that are happening. So sometimes it's quite hard, you know, working them all in because there are so many happening simultaneously. But, it's been really exciting. I've certainly seen a mixed bag, I can tell you, Dan.
I can imagine. Because the market yeah. is uncurated, effectively, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So I think how it works is sort of anyone can screen a film, you know, if they pay the fee, pretty much. So I have seen. I mean, I walked out of a film after 3 minutes yesterday, which was my personal record. So.
And
that one won't be screening in New Zealand next year, I can tell you that.
Well, you never know. Another distributor might pick it up, might fall in love with it. Maybe when we're off air, you can tell me what it was so I can look out for it.
But it's been fantastic. And the general buzz of Cannes, I mean, it's actually my second time I've been here, first for the festival in New Zealand, but it's just such an incredible buzz that you get. I mean, there are, you know, everyone pretty much of the film industry in the world is in the same place at the same time, and I think that, and you know, everyone that you bump into, you know, is a really interesting, has an interesting story to tell of, you know, what they've been up to in the last year and what their plans are for the future. So I think it's just fantastic place to be. You've probably heard that the weather has just been dire in the last week, so it has made life a little bit difficult.
Oh, it's great movie-going weather.
There's been a sloshing red carpet, and it's just been making life so hard getting from A to B, but apart from that, I can't complain.
No. Well, I was just going to ask you, you know, it is the most glamorous film festival in the world. So I'm presuming that amongst all of the screenings, you're getting to rub shoulders with the great and the good. Have you been invited to any cocktail parties on yachts?
To be honest, I haven't really. I've sort of been starting in Cannes so early every day, and then finishing, you know, when the last screening sort of finished around 10 o'clock-ish. And by then, I've got to sort of start looking at getting home because I'm commuting back, obviously, an hour out of Cannes. But, I mean, there are always stuff happening, you know, like cocktail parties in the early evening and so forth, which have been fun attending and so forth. But I haven't been onto one on a yacht yet. I might need to save that for next time.
Right. And have you seen much of the non-French content? Like, have you taken a bit of time out to check out the competition material? Or are you being very focused?
No, I have been really focused. I've seen the only non-French film I've seen was actually Shopping, which is due for a release in the next couple of next week.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. We would have watched it about the same time you did.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so I just thought I'd be a token Kiwi turning up to support them, so which I really enjoyed as well. But I have been to quite a few French films in the official selection as well. But mainly I did line up for the new Sofia Coppola film just to get my English-speaking film in, you know. But I lined up for 2.5 hours and still missed out on a ticket. So,
oh man, you could have watched a whole film in that time.
That was a huge fail.
Oh boy, that just shows you how tough it is at Cannes. And I mean, we forget that there's actually another festival going on at the same time, which is the Directors Fortnight. And quite a few of your titles in the festival this year were actually originally featured in Directors Fortnight. So have you been paying attention to them as well?
Yeah. it's always a category that interests me quite a lot. I think it's quite a carefully programmed category. And, I mean, I've seen a few this year which I've really, really enjoyed. You know, they're sort of a bit quirky, a little bit off the beaten track. So, yeah, I've definitely been paying attention.
Brilliant. Sarah Rees, you're the director of the Alliance Française French Film Festival in New Zealand. You've been talking to us live from Cannes. I'm determined not... I'm going to focus on that whole bad weather, rain, soaking wet shoes stuff,
yeah,
and not the...
make you feel a little bit better.
Exactly, exactly. Thanks very much for your time.
I think we should seriously look at doing a... live Cinemeta podcast from Cannes one day.
Brilliant. Well, tell you what, you talk to your mates, you talk to everybody you meet. You could give us a place on the Croisette. We'll happily broadcast live. Not a problem. Thanks very much for your time and have a fantastic day.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
Dirty Puff.
Hi, Rick.
Hi, Mr. Oswald.
Hi, darling.
I don't get it. Why is Rick the one they arrest?
Get a straight jacket!
He hit him really hard, Dad.
You want me to stay with you till you fall asleep?
That's okay.
Love you, love you, love you, love you, love you, love you.
Have to say that a film with the title Broken does seem a little bit unlikely in terms of, you know, pure entertainment value. Is the kind of thing that does a film called Broken, you know, encourage people to sort of cross the street and check it out? Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's actually a pretty good title for the film that they've made. Kaylee, you've watched this for us.
Yes, I did, and I'm so glad that I did. So based on the 2008 novel of the same name, this British coming-of-age drama is the story of 11-year-old girl Skunk, who witnesses her neighbor being viciously beaten by another neighbor. And it's what she witnesses is quite disturbing to her, and then within this small community, things start slowly unraveling based on this one event, and everyone sort of gets rolled into this really sort of terrible, violent cycle.
Repercussions,
and this violence begets violence, and there's these lies that are being told and are ruining people's lives, and it's intense. It's one of those British films that it's just, like, totally knocks you off your feet, and by the end, you just kind of want a little bit of a cry and some ice cream and a hug, and then you're like, actually, that was great. That was a great experience.
It's not quite as hard going as it's one of the, I'll just make the connection that it actually stars Tim Roth mm-hmm. as the Skunk's dad in the film playing and he's absolutely fantastic playing like the only sane person in the whole cul-de-sac. And you know, there are films from the 80s that he was in that were even more challenging and even more rigorous than this. I think that this has got a good heart to it and a good soul, but there are scenes that are very, very difficult to watch, and partly because it involves children, I think, because, you know, some of the violence is perpetrated by children, some of the violence is perpetrated against children, and the question I had while I was watching it was, you know, how real is this? How is this? This is kind of a, because all of this stuff happens in the one cul-de-sac, you know, the one, like three houses basically, and they all interconnect to such a point that everybody is completely damaged by what's gone on. It's like, is it credible? Mm. I guess, or does it matter?
Mm. I think when you're watching it, you feel like it does matter and it does feel credible, but it is so horrible. I mean, I can't say that it's based on true events because, you know, you'd think there'd be some sort of disclaimer at the beginning. But I thought it was just this really, because they've created this sort of microcosm of this cul-de-sac where all these things are happening, and yes, the violence extends to the school, which is obviously not terribly far away, but it's just this sort of like ball of negative that just keeps growing and growing and just sort of explodes at the end of the film. And you really care about Skunk, and you really care about, you know, these characters, and some of the characters you really hate, because it just shows that people aren't nice and people are horrible to each other. And
even children.
And children are horrible. If you've ever worked with children, you have children, you know that children can be horrible little creatures and they just don't care. Not all of them. Some of them are nice, but
you do get the impression, or maybe that
it's a pretty tough gig.
Yeah.
You don't most have kids any are pretty decent.
No, they're not. Try working at a summer camp.
Well, yeah, I'm the parent.
I got the impression that the three houses that are the central sort of part of the story, they represent parts of British society almost, right. As if you've got the completely off the rails feral household that where no rules apply.
So they're products of their environment.
Well, yeah. yes and no, but I think that there's a sense that this is a portrait of Britain. And, you know, in one little nutshell, and, you know, broken homes for one reason or another, or missing parents for one reason or another, or parents who, in the case of one household where the son is has some mental illness as well as intellectual disabilities, and, you know, where the parents just don't get him at all, you know, and that's a major part of the problem that he has, is that they care, and like everybody loves each other so passionately and they express their love so passionately. That doesn't mean they understand
or know how to take care of each other.
Or know how to take care of each other, exactly. That simply saying it over and over and over again isn't the same as living it, and you know, that's a really sort of key part of the part of the film. I want to talk a little bit about the central character of Skunk, who is played by Eloise Lawrence, who's 11 years old at the time that the film was made, and what a fantastic performance from a little girl to carry an entire film like this on her shoulders, and to do it with such life and sort of joie de vivre, and you know, it's fantastic. But everybody in it, there's not a bad performance really. You know, no. Cillian Murphy's in it. There's some really, really good people.
Yes, and in Hollywood's usual trope of using diabetics in films, when it starts out with the main character being identified as diabetic, you know it's not going to go well for them, really. Something's going to happen, because the character could just be diabetic and you don't need to know about it.
No, but but bad stuff needs to happen. So yeah. Yeah, but it all and actually, talking of tropes, bad stuff needs to happen, but it needs to not be her fault as well.
Mm.
So diabetes is a completely blame free type A or whatever it is. Right, it's like completely blame free. It's like you just get it, right? And it's not. So I can sort of understand. I can sort of understand that, but. So this is a film that's not playing all that widely at the moment. It's one of the smaller distributors around. It did actually win the Best Independent Film Award at the British Awards last year. So it does have a bit of a reputation, and it is worth looking for, but you will have to seek it out if you if you're keen. And so I'm going to ask you now, Kaylee, if you can come up with two words to sum up Broken.
My two-word review for Broken is emotional snowball. Bring some snacks to calm yourself down if you're like me.
Right. I'm just trying to think about my two words for Broken, and that would be bad neighbours. So that is our show, ladies and gentlemen. I know that we promised we'd be talking to Andy Miller from the Academy Cinemas, but the show is already epic in length, so we'll hold that over till next week. Also on next week's show, we're going to be talking to the two filmmakers, Mark Alberston and Louis Sutherland, about their film Shopping, which opens next week all over the country. So there's a couple of interviews to drop into next week's show. And also, we're going to be running the verdict on The Hangover 3. And maybe I should just ask, none of us have seen it yet?
No.
You haven't? Okay, great.
Have you seen the other two?
Yeah, I was just going to say, are you fans of the franchise, or is this going to be a trial for you to watch?
I wouldn't say I'm a fan, but they do make me laugh.
I'm a fan of the first one. I mean, just that whole shock treatment in a way, in a similar way, I guess. I was a huge fan of Borat, you know. It's just this fresh sort of making you cringe and laugh at the same time.
Yeah, let's see. Liked. Let's see whether the third one. They're back in Vegas, so maybe it will restore the luster of the original Hangover, which really was a terrific film. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favorite podcasting software, so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. And then, of course, your feedback at iTunes, ratings, reviews, etc., helps other people discover the show. Feel free to tell your friends as well, because you know, the audience is growing every week, but we can always do with a few more. And it would be really nice if we have more overseas as well, like Reese Pie, who's listening in England. So yeah, spread the word, everybody. How do you get back in touch with us and send us your two-word reviews and tell us where we've gone wrong?
You can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, and of course on our website at www.cinematica.co.nz.
Mm-mm. The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music. This is the closing theme music to Kon-Tiki, which is, I think, another sign. It's another example of the great ambition of the film. It's a fantastic soundtrack as well. And I could tell you that it is by Johan Söderqvist and Hans Eck and the Philharmonia Orchestra. Norwegian pronunciation being tested to the fullest there. Until
Scandinavian, is that an overarching term?
It is, yeah, I think so. Yep. Yeah, maybe I can get out of jail with that. Until next week, that is all from me.
All from me.
And me.
Right, see you all next week.